Happy birthday! The Whitlams turned 90 this week. That's right. The Sydney band has now been around longer than the Bismarck, the town of Gladstone, and Chairman Mao. Bob Hawke and Kim Beazley turned up to the party. The streets of Newtown never grooved so hard. In fact, the Sandringham Hotel even came to the party, taping dynamite to their slot machines to allow the public to blow up the last of the pokies on King Street. Even Johnny Howard rang Freeman and the fellas to wish them all the best on their ninth decade in entertainment. He also went on to say how happy he was that the band were historically instrumental in the mid-70s, turning off the colonial engine of aristocracy to allow New Guinea to govern with outright autonomy, with Australian funds, of course. He also graciously allowed the moment to say how thrilled he was Indonesians were at the helm of the other half, Papua. Less for him to worry about, he remarked. Happy birthday, Whitlams. Love, Shamrock.
Good evening, everyone out there. This is Talk Tank. My name is Martin. I'm your host for the next hour. And my co-host, welcome, Ian, Paul, and Tanya.
Hi.
Right, so who wants to start off after all this pre-recorded material we had?
Yeah, I'm a bit sore this week. I got nicked for selling counterfeit Viagra. And nobody told me that Korean backpacker spoke English. He said, tastes like mint. And I said, well, how was Tic Tacs meant to taste? And quick orthopedic to the codpiece, and I was still soon swooning the terra nullis. And beneath his wax-thin legs of a dead fly moustache, he said to me, well, now you need the real stuff, won't you? And while you're at it, you can sell me stuff.
It's like those stupid things on the internet, enlarge your penis. Look, I clicked that. I looked down. Same size as always.
Well, he said, I'm sticking to the gaffer tape and paddle bob sticks, whatever that means.
Wow. I was still trying to get a level right. Yeah, so I've got plenty of stuff recorded and also some print matter. What have you got?
I've got a story on ADHD drugs again.
Yeah.
Killer.
Ritalin is going to be prescribed to preschool children.
You're not right on the mic.
They do that
Ritalin
in the States.
Ritalin is going to be prescribed to preschool children against drug company advice. An ADHD specialist, I'm quoting the Sydney Morning Herald here, an ADHD specialist is quoted as saying, there is no doubt that the methylphenidate products were safe for and effective for children under the age of 6 with serious ADHD, but this is a drug company specialist. He says he would rather see critical free psych counselling, which may or may not be available later under a new mental health program within Medicare. I say I want to see John Howard on Ritalin.
Does this fellow actually have the letters MD or anything resembling them at the end of his name?
Doogie Howser.
I notice he's a drug company specialist, but
doesn't say, does
it? It is a doctor. It's in the Sydney Morning Herald. They didn't tell me who the doctor was. They didn't print who the doctor was.
I had to do a speech a couple of weeks ago at uni about ADHD, and so I did a bit of research. And in the United States, they're already giving ADHD drugs to preschool kids, and a whole bunch of people are dying of liver malfunction, and there's no follow-up. Teachers aren't doctors. Teachers give them, you know, the parents and the teachers work together, and you got to look out for signs of depression and all the rest of it. But the thing, some kids are dropping dead from toxic venom.
Below in the social ladder.
Would you ever
Judges are above. Doctors
yeah.
in the middle,
not in Denmark. Teachers get paid more in Denmark than
Would
doctors.
Would you ever give a child
Wales?
Under 6 something that has methylphenidate on the list of ingredients? Give
well,
me a break.
Well, between the age of anywhere from even 3, so especially around 4 and 5, that development area, the kids are hyperactive naturally, doesn't mean they have ADHD. It's later on in life that if they keep going on with the symptoms into their teenage years, then you usually know they've got ADHD. But at the age of 5, kids are naturally hyperactive. It's ridiculous.
It's also a very grey area. We're talking about a symptom of something that's not been formally medically recognised because, to the best of our knowledge, ADHD is a symptom of what we're now calling it. That may well later turn out to be a symptom of something else, if and when we actually have a formal medical definition of it. Because when last I heard, medical science was still to agree to one.
There's a German-American criteria. I failed the German one, but the American one I passed because I had to analyse myself because I was a rat bag at school. But there's a new system now which is 4-level, tiered level, and it's a whole different type of psychology, and it's a lot better. It's more natural. So anyway.
I'm interested in the new mental health program, the Medicare program.
Can we stick with the HDHD and the kids?
I'm always suspicious that these things too are. Yeah, I'm always suspicious that they're not too another one of these tail wagging the dogs, like the introduction of wide drug testing in American industry and their public service. And at the end of the day, it was found that the people who lobbied most for it were actually the manufacturers of the drug test. So I hope this is not another tail wagging the dog like that. Yeah.
This is the government prescribing that this be pushed ahead real fast, and this is the drug company saying, hey, whoa, which is what I found fascinating about the story.
Yeah. This tail is actually trying to hold the dog up.
Okay, well, what about Wayne's mum? She's got a story to tell. This is called Spawn, by the way. Wayne's Mum by Coral Spawn, that's local artists here, Doug and Biscuit and Lisa Yetz. Got other music from Lisa Yetz, and not with Coral Spawn, but we have that later. Tanya, who was on last? Who wants to go on?
Yeah. Oh, don't you like how that fellow on the glass house always manages to throw to a new subject by turning to somebody and going, you're a whatever, what about, you know, and you've got to go, oh, well, so-and-so, you're a whatever, and what about, and what about. He always manages to, you know, really totally grab someone by surprise. Unfortunately, we wanted to talk about mental health, so...
And we're all buggered. You can look at anyone in this room, we're all stuffed.
Yeah, we're trying to think of a way we can introduce each other like that without creating total umbrage, so...
We've got the mics in front of ourselves so we don't get paranoid and look around all the time at each other.
You're obviously an idiot. What's your opinion?
Yeah. Well, Tanya, you've got lots of things down there scribbled in writing that I can't read, which is
secret code.
Yeah. I used to have a boss that would analyse your handwriting and look horrified, so... So, let's see what it's about.
The secrets within the text.
Yeah. But don't speak there, speak into the mic.
Critical free psych counselling under Medicare. Oh. Who would benefit the most from such a thing? Around here. Costello.
Money would be flowing into the region. I think there'd be a lot of employment for new shrinks. We need counselling. We've got lots of shrinks. What is it they say? In the region, you can get whatever prescribed for however many years or whatever. You can be on benzodiazepines for decades, but go looking for 2 hours of counselling and you'll be looking for decades as well. So.
Yeah, there's always good advice at hand from them. I mean, you want to hear the advice for people who are suffering things?
Yep.
Yep. Well, then we've got... Medicinal marijuana users are warned, if you don't take your prescription on schedule, you could cause harm to yourself and others.
That's good.
So you heard it. Be warned.
Okay, we've now covered our backsides with the disclaimer. We can say whatever we like.
So
who came up with this idea about psychiatric counselling under Medicare? Anyway, is this whose initiative? We're keen to know.
Call in, whoever you are.
I'm sorry, I thought that was the subject of all these notes.
Been scratched. That'd be no good at the horses.
We had harm.
Oh, righty.
I could talk a little bit about bananas.
Mm-hmm. Bananas.
All right, the first bananas are going to be in sale in mid-September, the word from Tullian Innisfail, since Cyclone Screamin' Larry. On March the 20th, moosa trees carrying fruit at present. So that's starting to grow up there, which is nice to see. Did you know, guys, that we have three species of banana in North Queensland? Anyone know that?
No.
And some indigenous tribes used to make wine from them. True.
What?
We use Malaysian banana species, usually in Australia, and compete with South American corporations. Bent, no doubt.
Yeah, so once committed an act of animal cruelty with banana liqueur. I've long been a connoisseur of it. Yeah, and so's the poor little dog I got drunk.
Anyway, summer rains, i.e. the tropical monsoon here in Oz, has been windfall everywhere else otherwise, other than the cyclone, so things are good with the monsoon. But and bananas come back. I paid $1.20 the other day for a banana, and it wasn't even ripe.
Unripe.
A trend in Queensland that I ran across at the SOS conference was community-supported agriculture. And apparently if you Google community-supported agriculture, you'll find a lot of entries and very interesting reading.
Oh, yeah?
This guy was talking, it's a non-profit organisation, and they're the go-between between local farmers and local buyers. The farmers bring the produce in to this person. They distribute it in boxes. It gets taken out to certain headquarters in the cities, and people come in and buy off them, and they subscribe a month ahead, so the farmers get their money. The produce, no matter what the produce is, it's all different. It always gets bought because it's part of a box of food, and it's employment for all the people that are doing the driving and the gathering and the distribution. It's brilliant. That was part of the good news at SOS. There's a lot of bad news. If you're interested in that, I can...
Well, it's down in Brixton Markets or anywhere in London, they've got a no-blemish policy that all the fruit coming up from Bahamas or Africa or wherever it might come from has to be unblemished. Now, there's a good argument there for biotechnology as far as genetically engineered fruit that ripens slowly so that third world countries can have sustainable crop usage of fruit that ripens. It's nice and hard on the boat, and it ripens slowly on the boat in the way to England, so it's there unblemished. So it depends how you look at these things. There's a good debate with that.
It encourages irradiation too, and at times not complete honesty about irradiation when you become totally pedantic about your blemishing. I think we're a bit that way with the North Queenslanders, in spite of the cyclone doing to the North Queensland crop what basically a lot of the growers around here are probably hoping that Blackstick or Toka or something similar does instead. As it turns out. Apparently you can't have too many blemishes on your fruit from the far north either because it's regarded as more likely to... imports from the Philippines particularly, we're extremely strict on those.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, the fruit fly did come in from Africa into Darwin and North Queensland a few years ago, and living in Darwin, your mango grows, even on council property up there, and there's no blemishes. There's hardly any fruit fly in Darwin. It's beautiful. But spending time in Brisbane, there's loads of mango trees also in Brisbane, but the fruit's rancid with fruit flies, so head to Darwin if you want a good mango.
Oh, all right.
Darwin.
Better still buy them green.
Mm. Yeah.
Yep, green mango and purple salads.
Mm.
Ooh, green mango and eggplant fried in the morning.
Yeah. Well, I haven't got a fruit thing, but I've got an environmental thing here. Out of the archive again. Can we hear that?
Yep.
No amount of talk about greenhouse. Oh, global warming can hide the bare fact that this planet is fast becoming an unpredictable hellhouse.
How was that?
Yes. Lovely.
It doesn't sound too reminiscent at all. Yet again, one of the mildest winters on record. We are having a bit of a winter, aren't we?
Yeah.
It felt a bit like one for a day or two last week.
Wettish, sort of. Yeah. Which helps, doesn't it? Do you want me to read something, or is Tanya again? I've got some of the recorded stuff, but it's international stuff, so I thought I'd let you have the local stuff first, and the regional, and non-politician stuff.
It would appear that within about a week of, just locally too, within about a week of within weeks of one of the most intense police operations we've had in this town, it would appear that this town's back to its normal level of vandalism and assaults and the assaults and the usual minor and at times not so minor crime. If you ask certainly if you ask the people that are trying to run the Nimbin Hemp Museum at the moment, yeah. I guess it shows how.
You never know. It's for a month.
I think it shows how effective it is. You know, spending the amount of money that it would that you could house 10 people within this place just to get some extra police in, basically to kick the guts out of our annual festival and suddenly find within a matter of weeks. Well, how effective has it really been against the crime? How many people who actually live here were consulted on this operation, and how much of it was just bright ideas from people outside of Nimbin who've got their own smart-ass notion about what they think this town needs.
If anyone doesn't know, the Mardi Gras this year, we had about, I think, 80 police at one stage, but we had a lot of these guys. I was calling them rock and roll wrestlers and overtime tax down payments. So these guys were monsters, and they went away feeling like they wasted their time, because most people in Nimbin are pretty free-loving, caring, kind people.
Yeah, I've got an archive piece on homelessness. It's got a wider application, I reckon, a world global application, this one. In Detroit, USA, Alfred, the homeless man, just noticed how many different kinds of bridges there are. He said, there's the kind with the trusses and the suspension bridges. Bridges of fun. A more detailed analysis from an interview taken by Toonim FM's French correspondent reveals a different picture. I'm here in Paris, the capital of the homeless, and Pierre tells that in the older days, the homeless were called clochards, a respectable term for those few well-mannered and educated homeless. Now in the 2002, there are well over 100,000 of us clochards, but the government has not added any new bridges to live under. Every night you can see evictions from some who then become homeless or bridgeless. We urgently need more bridges crossing the River Seine for the swelling numbers of clochards in Paris. So much from Paris tonight.
The big issue with the magazine that is sold on the street by the street people and homeless people to get a few dollars in their pocket turned 10 this month.
All right.
I've got a copy of it.
10
bloody wonderful.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Really good. So pick up your The Big issue in any newsagents or order it. It's a good magazine.
Yeah. Have you got any stuff to talk about, Tanya, on your little trip away this week?
I've got to add to this.
Oh, okay.
One short note from a feature story from melbourneindiemedia.org. People's Demands by Geelong Trades Hall, or Geelong Trades Hall, July 11. We suggest the following, quote, people demands as the minimum to start this process. 1. National awards to be established for every occupation. Whilst the award system was not a panacea for all, it did establish panacea for all, it did establish basic pay and working conditions for all. 2. Abolition of Australian workplace agreements. 3. Unjust and unfair dismissal provisions to apply to all. 4. Right of employees to be represented in the workplace. 5. Abolition of Howard's building industry Gestapo, quote. The right to collectively bargain industry agreements. 6. And 7. End the exploitation of guest workers and refugees. 8, immediate increase in employed training for our young. 9, independent industrial disputes resolution commission. And 10, people's declaration. We declare that we will not vote for any political candidate who does not commit totally to supporting and implementing these fundamental and minimum people's demands.
10 commandments.
Words, yeah. But anyway, that's what they say. Feature story in themedia.org can read the full blow. I only read the headlines of those 10 articles. There's to each article a little explanation on the website. Jeez. So that's a feature story present on melbourneindiemedia.org.
Yes, Labour will probably get their preferences by the sense of it.
Oh, yeah, we could, you know, drag some of the socialist alliance over to the anarchist alliance, and then from the rainbow faction of the ecological Koori group, they can drag some greenies over into the Green Party.
I wonder. Yeah, that's probably the most. They say being leader of the opposition is the most difficult job in politics. Now, I think it's it's the poor guy in the opposition party that's got to go and negotiate the preferences of all those very radical fringe parties. That's probably got the most difficult. It's going to have the ulcer and be tearing his hair out at the end of the day.
I think Howard might be asking for Don Burke to champion that cause.
Yes. Give us your preferences, or we'll bury you out in the backyard.
and my little pug will lick your face.
Oh yeah.
We'll cover you in honey and put you in an anthill, and we will hope nobody finds you.
Just bring the dog. There's no way they'll be able to say that.
Bring in the honey badger and lick you to death.
Oh dear.
How did the new IR laws go? Are they passed yet?
What's
happened? Does anyone know?
Yeah, it's constantly
IRA laws.
Fights all over the place, everywhere
It's the opposition's stand that Labor actually will remove them if elected. That's been the big issue of the week, or at least of the last month or so. Anyway, yeah, the major story of Australian politics that and the constant bickering at the top.
Yeah, I've done my thing on that earlier.
Follow
on.
The leader.
You didn't hear that earlier.
Yes, we've all heard it. As John keeps telling us, you've all heard it before. He said he reserved the right to run. Yeah. You've heard it before. Yes, he sounds a bit like the jockey that's
got. We've got more here. We've got some international stuff, if nothing else wants to get first.
I like the idea of Johnny Howard saying, I'm of sound mind and body, I'm healthy and I'm sane and I am. You know I am. You've heard me.
Oh, don't you worry about that. Yes.
Yeah.
Obviously. So, Joe. My policies. I'm sane, I tell you.
Yeah, I've got a little funny one for that later. But Cuba's back in the limelight with America's thing here. I'll just play the thing I recorded here. It's all from media clips put together. So, I should go here.
We're laying the groundwork to offer specific, substantial assistance for a democratic transition in Cuba, including humanitarian aid and support for the recovery of those fundamental democratic rights and economic freedoms that lead to prosperity. The Commission's second report keeps the promise that the United States has made to the people of Cuba. You have no greater friend than America. You can always count on our support, and we will be ready to stand with you through the process of transformation to your democratic future.
The $110 million Democracy Fund will help finance opposition groups in Cuba and provide what the U.S. calls uncensored information to Cuba through satellite radio and TV broadcasts.
We will do all this and more, provided we are asked by a Cuban transition government that is committed to dismantling all instruments of state repression and implementing internationally respected human rights and fundamental freedoms, including organizing free and fair elections for a democratically elected new Cuban government within a period of no more than 18 months.
And it's clear now, and there's a greater prominence of Raul now in the state-controlled media and other places, that he is the anointed successor. The question is, One, is this going to be an individual succession, or is this going to be more of an institutionalized succession? And in the past month, we have seen a strengthening of the party, the Communist Party of Cuba, the only party in Cuba. We have seen the creation or the reestablishment of the secretariat of the party with Raul and Fidel at the helm. So there is a vision that the Cuban leadership has that the succession not be an individual succession, but an institutionalized succession, and led by the party, the military, and the security apparatus. My view is that the succession will be easier and quick, and the transition in Cuba will be long and difficult.
So I think we've got to plan for the worst and hope for the best.
Fidel Castro says, companion dropouts, there's too much bongo playing going on. The economy is bad. For now, no more bongo playing. Is this clear? Bongo no.
Bongo si? Bongo si?
Bongo si?
Bongo si?
Bongo si?
Bongo si?
Bongo si?
Bongo
si? Back live on air. That was an archive piece added to the coverage of the indoctrination of America on Cuba. That's an interesting, funny thing, isn't it? They're trying to teach Cubans about democracy.
Including that very rare archival footage of Condoleezza Rice auditioning as a concert pianist, attempting a monologue. I think it was then they really broke it to her. Condoleezza, you're not going to make it in this field. You should try a career in
diplomacy. She can't dance the cha-cha, mate. That's no chance with Cuba.
I think she should go right back to concert pianist, actually.
No, she will continue Bible classes in the future, I reckon.
Make you spit your cigar out.
Advanced Bible classes.
Living proof that not all black guys can jump.
All right, let's get content here. Substance, guys.
Cuba. I saw a beautiful film on how Cuba reacted to the peak oil crisis when America did the embargo thing trip on them. And, you know, it was just showing how they all turned to permaculture and every single square inch of space was used for growing your veggies.
That's very interesting. And, all you see normally is the missile crisis with John F. Kennedy in the foreground.
Well, and pictures of people doing naughty things in Guantanamo Bay. Yeah.
Organic carrots.
That's how we know Cuba. This is fascinating. This film was about an hour long, 53 minutes long, and it was just beautiful. You know, obviously it was all happy, happy people, and aren't we doing so well? And nothing about, you know, political problems. But when America started doing the no oil to Cuba, or you can't land in our docks for 6 months, and when it got worse and worse and worse, they imported 1.5 million bicycles from China and started manufacturing more. So everyone was on their bikes.
Jeez.
You could drag
the canals of Amsterdam and find a few too.
Oh yeah, couldn't you just?
Yeah.
Did you tell me about the potato crop? About someone told me that Cuba had a really good potato crop one year, and this is probably the beginning of the permaculture stuff, obviously. Hmm. And America came in and dropped this bug, and wiped their potato crop out.
Oh, the blight.
Yes, you know, we are your best
friend.
Good
English invention,
that one. There is no greater ally to Cuba than America, you know.
Well, when they sun it with all guns, you know, I've been getting really angry.
We completely forgive you for shooting our president.
But I have to...
the other point was that one other thing that came up during the SOS to do with this sort of thing is that England faced the same sort of crisis in the Second World War. In 18 months, they had people feeding themselves from their own gardens, from rooftop gardens. Every available square inch of space, was turned into veggie gardens.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to have to do, was the point.
I had a tiny little plant box in me.
Take note, Coles and Woolworths, we can do it without you.
I used to live from a tiny little planter box in Newtown, or not all my food, obviously, but a lot of it, just out of this tiny little planter box. I used to grow all sorts of things in it.
I used to visit this place in Melbourne. It was an artist's apartment, and they had this kind of grey sort of, you know, inside their place was lovely, but outside was all sort of grey buildings and cement everywhere. But right in the middle of the car park, in the courtyard of their apartments, was this sort of, they'd pulled up the cement, right, the squares, and they'd planted a veggie garden there, and it was gorgeous. There were like birds and butterflies and beans and sunflowers. It was like a drawing, you know.
Goldfish.
Two or three or four of those like paver squares of cement they'd just ripped up and cultivated,
yeah.
And it was amazing. It was
that's
like
why they call it in Berlin, it's
easy to do.
The old saying in Berlin is the beach is under the pavement. It also implies that you pick up a rock, you know, and do something with it. Move it through the air, probably.
Did anybody catch?
Unfortunately, it hits a police car. It could happen.
Germans are so obscure.
Yeah, okay, yeah, very tricky. But I have to put something again. To be, you know, we are in MFM. Every indie media is proud of having people speaking up against Cuba, you know, about all their war crimes and all their criminal and their human rights violations and all this. So I said my thing. I just had to say it, you know, because every indie media page has got one or the other writer retorting with, oh, but they're going to look at people, you know, and they're going to do experiments on me, you know.
No one likes a dictator. No one likes being told what to do. That's basically it.
Especially a potato dictator.
An indie media writer.
One of the more profound things about food growing up, the whole GMO debate, and how we should be, how organic should we be going with our food, was said by the guest of the National Press Club luncheon this week, one of the two award-winning Australian doctors that basically... helped to put an end to what was then the multi-billion dollar peptic ulcer cure industry, which involved all sorts of terrible drugs and drastic surgical options.
Yeah.
Just basically by this one Australian doctor who collaborated with another doctor and discovered that the peptic ulcer was not caused by business-related stresses.
Yes, we had thought all this
bacteria,
time,
isn't it? But by a spiral-shaped bacteria that was actually existing in this, that was peculiar in the stomach of all peptic ulcer sufferers. And was curable by a simple antibiotic. The initial discovery was scoffed at because conventional thinking at the time was that no conventional bacteria could exist within what was regarded as the bacteria-free environment of the stomach, where only primitive enzymes are believed to be able to exist for any great amount of time. So initially the theory widely scoffed. Now, one thing he said about food, and it stuck in my mind, this guy said, because he was a guy who knew what it was like to have a great discovery originally derided, partly because it threatened what was then a multi-billion dollar industry, but just because it challenged conventional thinking then about bacteria in the stomach. Go to a country like India, go to Bangladesh, go to the third world where people still know the real feeling of hunger, and ask them about the GMO debate there. It's not a debate about good and bad there. GMO debate is not a bad debate there.
Well said.
We may not go GMO, but we may have to go some sort of high tech with our food. Someone said 5 years ago, you know, if we use every bit of arable land to efficiently grow food like the Cubans are, everywhere in the world, we still just might feed the 6 billion people we've got. What's going to happen next year when we've got more, and the year after that when we've got more? Don't be too dismissive of high tech.
I tell you what, though, I mean, the benefits of going permaculture is that there'll be less labour. It's less labour intensive once the thing gets going. So we're not exactly swallowing up our labour force by doing it. Initially, yeah, there's going to be a big effort. But because it's particularly permaculture that we're concentrating on, you know, air quality, soil quality, their soil quality is up over the top. It's beautiful. And that's less pollution, less CO2, you know, they've got to use animals instead of machinery, so that's less oil. It's so many things are benefits from this activity that you can't really sort of, you know, a lot of arguments, yeah, are put against it, obviously, but it's a very dynamic system. My other point was, what were you saying about Jim? It's the poor people in those countries that are getting tested on for the long-term effects of GMO crops, okay?
Monsanto.
Bangladeshi Women's Bank was this, it's called microeconomics or something like that. It's like when a small collective gets together in devastatingly poor countries, and they, you know, they have a certain amount of something like what crop that they've made, and they all put in together, and they can loan out small amounts, micro amounts.
You can get started. very little.
You know about it? It's
yeah.
But this
yeah,
and
been
but
in India.
Monsanto and Citibank yeah. and Suncor maybe. Anyway, don't quote me on
yeah,
it, but Monsanto
benches,
definitely came in
range,
with
yeah.
their grain packets of
yep.
GMO,
yep.
GM-modified wheat, and said, here, this is our gift to you. You
broken
can use this for your
blah, blah, blah,
microclimates. This is your seed bank. And they were testing the long-term results of GM-modified wheat
yeah.
on these people who had nothing else, and that was their staple diet,
yep.
and that's what they were doing. So
charming. They were getting meal seeds too, weren't they? Seeds you had to keep going back and getting. They couldn't...
Yeah.
And probably none the wiser about
and,
that as
and,
well.
And patented herbicides that only help the superbugs that are afflicted to these crops.
Life
they know nothing sad. About the results of this on the human body. They
yeah.
to find
There's
somewhere.
Another point to permaculture or similar organic methods of growing. It's the health factor, you know. Food is a living thing, and human bodies or any animal needs living food. Dead food, like stored food, what the military keeps for 20 years or so, is basically just ballast and an extra load for your system, and all it gets is a little bit of glucose out of it, you know.
Yeah.
Cuba are manufacturing biofertilizers now. They used to have like the largest amount per hectare in the world. You
we
know,
do it locally, yeah.
Biomass
New
of fertilizers. Now they're manufacturing biofertilizers. They've taken care of their pesticides problem because they're rotating their crops.
Yep.
You know, they are actually wanting the bugs to come into
yeah.
the crops.
I don't
because
think we need to argue for that.
It, it's, you know,
it's
just these things
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
you
well
brought
recognized.
It up and this
okay.
is
it's well recognised here in Nimbim, at least. You know.
Okay. If,
yeah.
Okay. If there's not a lesson in these things, there may be a lesson in the Mycenaeans, the world's first history's first recorded granary, or at least the oldest one we know of. Now. yes, it may well have been the first one we got our ergot fungus from too and discovered on
yeah,
the next
fungus, yeah.
Responsible for our massive cases of ergotism in this town.
Why? Yes, someone was telling me the other day I had a huge ergo. I just thought, oh, I'm sorry. I'm trying to adjust my trousers. Yeah. Anyway,
getting some counterfeit Viagra.
The thing is, the oldest...
it's actually not the food. It's the way people live in cities. It's urban, overwhelming urban population, which makes up the 6 billion or 7 billion we are. You know, the distribution of it is the problem, you know.
The thing is, we didn't get history's first recorded granary. History's first recorded granary was not the subject of a primitive growing operation. It was the result of what was, for its time, a very high-tech irrigation operation. That resulted in history's first granary, and we didn't get all that grain stored in one place by the Mycenaeans just because somebody happened to be a capitalist bastard and that is human nature. No, it happened because a civilization was jammed between two other civilizations in a drought-ridden countryside and had nowhere else to go. History's first granary, history's first recorded large-scale community cropping operation involved irrigation, and it happened for no other reason than because people got desperate.
But what about the yams in Papua New Guinea when they've been storing them in the yam houses for countless millennium, you know, because that's the way they get stored, and that's got nothing to do with irrigation. That's just storing food, you know. It's
bio-generated soil too in South America. That they only just cottoned onto that in the last 5-10 years.
Charcoal,
and
the charcoal.
Yeah, and it's
yes.
just humus building
yeah,
up in...
Boy.
In savannah and rainforest
out there
areas.
In the corner would have something to say about that, maybe.
Yeah, and
that,
they were whole sediments, and they use irrigation alongside
it
that. And the whole community sort of... And then, of course, your Spanish turned up with the smallpox and helped wipe some of that out as well.
Yeah, yes.
Social change.
Oh, but those diseases did that they could never have achieved at gunpoint.
Yeah. Well, let's bring Ian's Shamrock News in, shall we?
Yep.
It's all... I mean, we've done it for the show, so we should play it now.
Another crisis in the Middle East sent traders into a familiar frenzy, pushing the World Anxiety Index, or the crude oil price, to a peak of $76.55 US a barrel.
I apologise, that's the wrong card here. Really sorry for that. And got to get the Shamrock News, performed by Ian Brown.
Shamrock News this week.
Mars? The moon?
Nope. We will soon be swinging from an iceless hammock in a cosy little harbour hamlet in Antarctica.
Yep, Robert Dunbar from Stanford University believes that atmospheric CO2 will double within the next century, and trees will grow again where once ice sheets, and if you're extremely lucky, moss and algae, once roamed supreme in Antarctica. I'm fascinated, because I'm a big fan of Gondwanan flora, and New Zealand, Oz and South America were all joined to Antarctica in Gondwanan days, and still have trees such as Araucaria genus, the Norfolk pine, seen along Manly Beach and even in Cape Town, South Africa, and our very own rainforest hoop pine, Cunningham eye, here in northern New South Wales, and the corroboree enticing Bidwilly eye, the tasty bunyanup pine, southeastern Queensland, the Blue Mountains' very own rare and ancient Wollamai pine, with a curious survival strategy, hiding from fire in sheltered sandstone canyons, rooted to highly acidic soils and existing on a single genotype. Disease could wipe the whole colony out. So let's do it right. Plant out the sheltered Australian Territory Antarctic harbours with glorious Gondwanan botany. Let's find a new home for the asexual dormant Antarctic beech tree. We can throw in a few New Zealand kauri trees. Keep our kiwi cousins happy. A few kiwi birds even, and the tuatara. And our very own platypus. Not too extravagant, isn't it? Hey, we could even open a Doyle's fish restaurant. I mean, no one is making money from our limited coastal fish stocks. And besides, they taste bitterly like dioxins anyhow. Not good with the beer batter. What do you mean they'll taste too oily in Antarctica? A novel idea. We can flood the Great Artesian Basin, one-fifth the size of arid Oz, with the tropical Gulf of Carpentaria's ocean water and caviar. Yep, we can flood the desert, name it Lake Fecundity. The basin is almost empty anyhow. Too many bores, a war we lost. Salinity? You'll notice, it's already there. And the last time I looked, pelagic fish weren't hoof placental mammals. So no fear of evolutionary ladder jumping to land erosion. We'll supply the new Australia, the Great South Manly and Watson's Bay, where the warm wind whistles through the returning Gondwanan conifers. Besides, Ken Domes is already there. In New Sydney, painting up a storm. Old Sydney to New Harbour, yacht race. Hooray, hooray, global warming, global warming.
Yeah, well, that was lovely. The Shamrock News again, and I love them every week.
I don't think your average explorer and sailor is going to really marvel at the few remaining wallabies planted around their harbour. No, they'll just stop there for a piss some time and just be happy that no dog shit there or something. I don't think we're really going to appreciate the full splendour unless it's explained to them by a botanist or at least an officer from the National Park Service
or a pirate selling the Wallamai pine seed to Montana.
What about swimming through Sydney and, sort of diving around the Centrepoint Tower and calling it the ancient civilization of Sydney? You'd have a religion based around it,
Oh, yeah.
Like Atlantis. And they used to do this and they used to do that.
It's another religion. That's just what we need.
Well, Atlantis City had the Olympics, so did Sydney, so it could be Atlantic City.
And the reason your skin falls off when you swim around there is because you're evolving.
We used to, I used to study over near there at one stage a few years back, and used to always see the people in the big white suits.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought I was back in penitentiary, but it's actually, they were just, with the dioxins clearing it out and doing tests on it. It was quite intimidating.
I've got a statistic here for climate change. We're now comparable to the Ice Age. The difference was from, 5 degrees Celsius? You were a climate change person, would you agree with that? They're saying at the present rate, our difference between the last ice age and now is going to be 1.4 degrees Celsius to 5.8 degrees Celsius. Now they're saying that means that they're saying that the weather now, the change in the weather patterns and the degree the temperature rise is more dramatic than what brought about the last ice age.
Yeah, it's
true. Comparable.
This is the fastest increase in temperature fluctuations and actual straight out increase ever in all the ice isotopes tests taken.
Yeah,
I mean, you got to understand
200 years or
they're growing.
Years or?
Well, that
That's the problem. They're forecasting things the next 50 years, and already in the last 2 months, they've jumped up on temperatures, saying they're going to increase by another 2 degrees Celsius in 100 revising. Years. So they're going up and up every week. There's a new statistic saying so it's going to get hotter and hotter.
Well, there's statistics around now, which are uncertain times.
Well, they used to have grapes growing in the Roman times in England, and it was only within the last 1,000 years that England was actually a lot warmer than it is now, and there is fluctuating temperature.
I like the long-term statistics, actually. I like the sort of that statistic between when the industrial age started in England now. And the carbon levels in the Antarctic snow that they've taken from the core drilling. Yes. I find those statistics interesting. I think anything measured around sort of the present is really dodgy and can be tampered with, obviously. But I like the long-term statistics. I think they tell more. And that was an interesting one. I thought, well, that's fascinating to me.
Those ice core samples give us accurate indications of the state of our atmosphere for up to 500,000 years.
Yeah, they're real.
We didn't have that at the start of the greenhouse debate. And it definitely told us that we've had ice ages come and go in that time. But at no time have we had a temperature change in any time in that 500,000 years as severe as what we have had since the start of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
But get this, we have had carbon levels higher and lower. You know, there have been fluctuations in the carbon levels, not necessarily the temperature.
Well, there were more forests.
There's a funny distinction between that.
There were more forests.
That's on the other side of the debate. That's for the people saying there is no such thing as global warming, blah-de-blah-de-blah, because the carbon,
You've also got volcanoes. But
there was a dramatic rise during the Industrial Revolution, and it had nothing to do with nature. It had to do with us and our interaction with nature.
No doubt.
Yes, we've had changing carbon levels, but at no stage as profound as the ones we've been having.
The increases. Is very
or
dramatic.
Human, or you know, call, we can look point pinpoint that and go, we did that. That's the difference.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt. Most people believe it now. Nearly every scientist on the planet pretty much now agrees with it. You get a few that, you know, the fossil fuel lobby groups might grab on site and pay them a few extra dollars to say it's not happening. But at the end of the day, I mean, only 4 years ago, it was like nearly 50-50, but now you're looking at least probably 80 to 90% of scientists worldwide believe that we're doing this.
George Bush believes it because he's waiting for X Day, mate, for the rapture.
It's a shame because
he's got no direction because he doesn't need any more. It's finished.
George Bush's own oil industry should be lining up to strangle him because it's George that kept the world arguing the toss about what was causing greenhouse.
Yeah.
And not enough about how we were actually going to cop this 0.5 degrees, you know, or whatever change, which doesn't sound like much. Well, I'm sorry, if you don't notice a 0.5 degrees change for 9 months of the year, maybe that extra couple of degrees in the peak of the American hurricane season that sends a few rushing up the alleyway of your major refineries, you might start to notice it then.
There goes Thanksgiving turkey.
I hope they stopped arguing the toss about it now.
No, I think they just want a lot of people to turn into dinosaurs and die and form oil, so they do want us to die off, so there's more oil for the future.
Yeah. And
That's a good one for green funerals, isn't it?
Okay.
Secure the future for your children. Become a fossil fuel.
Another crisis in the Middle East sent traders into a familiar frenzy, pushing the World Anxiety Index, or the crude oil price, to a peak of $76.55 US a barrel.
And sent share markets into sharp decline. Nervous investors watched the All Ordinaries Index slump by more than 100 points, 2%.
Australia's trade performance, a 3% jump in imports due largely to expensive oil, saw Australia's trade deficit double to almost $2.3 billion.
Where you look between Iran, North Korea, and the Middle East, it's all been one geopolitical factor after another, and they don't seem to stop.
Also including oil, plunged more than 20%, while coal was also down. It's tumbled around the world as investors flock to safe haven investments.
Yeah, we're back on air here. What do you reckon? Does any thought come up? Connections with what's going on geopolitically?
Reminds me of how mysteriously the Chinese were targeted in the Solomon Island riots just after the China came here.
Yeah.
It was almost like, look what we can do. Twiddle, 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 and there's suddenly a riot. I'm the only one that has this opinion, but, you know, to me, yeah. I do agree that there's a lot of manipulation going on with it.
Well, that's happened everywhere, even, you know, through Indonesia as well, with all the Chinese working in big business and running the towns around. That's what happened to Solomon Islands. The first place that burned down was the Chinatown.
Yeah.
And it's like the Indians in Fiji.
There's more resentment there for the Chinese than there is for the Indonesians in Timor.
Yeah.
Understandably,
yeah.
But also...
you know, but Dick Cheney is directly profiting of this now.
Yeah, how do you make these people more irate? Go out there and basically bomb the crap out of their basic amenities, destroy every basic living dwelling in their town, or just go there and make a little bit more money than they do? Which one makes them angrier?
The surveyors, no? You find a new oil field, you have a new war. You know, simple as that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would appear so. Okay, who's benefiting at the moment from Israel? From Israel being in the poo books with both the Gaza and Lebanon at the same time.
Americans selling them arms.
Halliburtoning the planet. You know, that's what's happening. Halliburton is directly profiting from this instability where the stocks go crazy and the oil rocks up. You know.
Oh.
Yeah. Hmm. Banks
yeah.
and oil companies.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be paying less than $1.20 back to being paying something civilised for petrol so long as all these people are throwing bombs at each other.
It won't go above $2 a litre. It won't go. It just stops flowing. You know, go up to $2 and that tapers off and then there will be this supply disruption. That's a scenario I read from GeoSurveyor exploration company people. You know, they know exactly that. It's going to be disrupted because just too many people wanting the available oil.
And even if you want to run your car on biodiesel, it comes from the vegetable oil from the palm plantations in Indonesia where the
palm oil, that's African palm oil, but they're grown in Indonesia, but it's actually an African species.
I thought Indonesia was the biggest exporter.
Yeah, they grow it in Indonesia. It's like our...
Oh, and they take it to Africa to process? Is that what you're
saying? No, African oil palms, it's from around the Congo, from the equator, but it's grown worldwide. Indonesia grows it. It's African species, that's all I'm saying.
Oh, okay, it's an African species. But, yeah, I mean, one of my big sort of owls from the SOS conference was, oh my God, you can't even biodiesel isn't biodiesel because of the poisons that are killing the plantation workers and the hours and the conditions and, you know, and they're leveling, that's Indonesia, sending in militia to crush the skulls of the workers when they get a bit too sort of bothersome.
Charming.
Yeah, now the irony is the military will claim the last reserves to fight wars about oil, you know, which is not there anymore. That's the irony. They're propelling.
The military's there crushing the skulls of workers for the... it's called... Basically using the same argument that the oil industry's...
Energy security policies in every country, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same argument the oil industry was using 10 years ago to tell us that renewable fuels will never compete with us. I said, why? He said, oh, you'd have to pay twice as much for your petrol, wouldn't you? Mm. I'm sorry, guys, it's 2006, and guess what I'm paying for my fuel? I'm paying 2.5 times what I was paying when that man was pissing in my pocket with that fallacious argument.
Yeah, my Learjet costs a lot, too, to run 2006.
Yeah. Hmm. Anyway, it's a crazy world, this connection and the wars with it. You know, that's why I put this card together. Anyway, that's my little spoof. We've got a funny thing here from the leaders of the world, and I can't find it. Where is it? A funny one. Remember that? The Beats.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of archive pieces here from the MFM, from 6 years of making things. but here it is. Let's have a listen what they do here to get their grooves up or something.
Jobs. Judy.
John Howard. Enemy.
Jobs. Judy.
John Howard. Enemy.
Jobs. Judy.
John Howard. Enemy.
Jobs. Judy.
John Howard, 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 enemy.
Jobs.
Judy.
John Howard, enemy.
Jobs. Judy.
John Howard, enemy.
Jobs.
Judy.
John Howard.
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 Enemy.
Jobs. Judy. John Howard. Send me.
Jobs.
Judy.
John Howard. Send me.
I like Mr. Costello. For the next piece.
I'm not sure if I do.
The next Republican president, apart from very likely celebrating his 80th birthday in common with former President Clinton, like the present president has his 60th, will probably, among other things, have to get very used to liking Peter Costello and having him following around carrying his coattails.
Turkey slapping him.
Oh, he wants so much to follow in the footsteps of John Howard.
Yeah, he's got a beautiful smile. The Costello
smile. Better looking than maybe the American public will be sort of more into.
Yeah. No, we love him all.
Diplomacy.
I think he should grow a little handlebar moustache. That looked funny, wasn't it?
You can be his PR manager. I'll take you to the hairdressers, darling. We'll get you sorted out immediately.
I mean, the whole time what he was treasurer, like a robot could have done that, you know what he did.
The public would like you more of a small... A small bout of syphilis would help you with the public?
Yeah.
Easily erased.
What are you telling us here, Tanya?
Okay. We can arrange this.
Long of clips here.
any other bright ideas?
Just remember, when Howard was treasurer... Malcolm Fraser was still Prime Minister, doing even more terrible things to some of our public institutions than the present government is now. But basically, Howard, they're wanting to do even more terrible things. I think the public impression at the time was that if we ever had John Howard as Prime Minister, he'd be doing all the things that Malcolm wants to do but hasn't got the guts to.
Yeah.
One of my earliest political memories is when Malcolm Fraser came into power.
Yeah, same here.
I was listening to a discussion between two workers doing some drain cleaning at my infant school.
Yeah, I was an infant too, yeah.
And one of them said, didn't you know that the Prime Minister was Fraser now? And I pricked up my little ears and went, oh, yeah.
You said,
my first political memory.
You saw the picture of the Queen on the wall in the early 70s.
Hey, that's when we used to get really, really worried in infant school when the planes went over because the Falklands War was on. And we used to all go, which kind of went on into the Cold War fear thing and those programs on the TV about post-Holocaust survival. It's just
playing elections on that still, you know. Contemporary, no. I've just seen a
foreign
thing, yeah. The Argentinians, I mean. They're sort of.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Oh,
yeah.
In Argentina? What, not in America?
Yeah, no, they're making, that's like all spin for being elected as being tougher on England, you know.
Left-wing governments in South America, a string of them has taken office since the election of the Bush government, and there's been another bit of a wave of nationalism in Argentina as well.
Also it costs England a fortune to maintain that community and protect it, you know. So the Argentinians still think it's theirs, you know. Malvinas, it's called. You know?
Rock of Gibraltar, Spain.
No, Malvinas. that's a different one. That's where the
analogy
sit. The English monkeys. No, the Gibraltar monkeys.
The internet domain is still short
anyway,
from Albania.
There's still a sentiment, you know, against Britain and a claim on the islands and by Argentinian people.
Last I checked, there's still less than 1,000 people actually living at Stanley, the main island, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of when you learn history, and they want to teach history in this country, you know, they're really keen to teach history to kids, you know, and they want to teach Australian history. That's a construct I can't understand, but if they teach history and they're not willing to learn from it, you know, what's the point of teaching history?
Lest we forget. We really did forget.
Yeah, well, the main lessons have not been learned yet, you know.
All we're teaching the children of today is it doesn't matter what we say, we'll just go ahead and do what the public don't want anyway. You know, this is such a paradox.
And
it must
kids,
be very confusing.
The kids like Tanya seem to remember that war is wrong.
Yeah, and be smarter at shopping.
I took my son to this Indonesian talk about the plantations, and it was a film and a discussion. And when we, you know, they sort of were kids, and I noticed that they were watching and kind of engrossed. And I thought, okay. And we were walking away, and I said, "So, what did you think about that? And you know, what would you do about it if you were my age?" And he said, "Oh, I'm going to become a famous actor and get rich and then help those people."
Yeah.
Okay.
And get plastic surgery to look like those people.
Yeah. I have a story here from sydneyindymedia.org, a feature story, the top of the webpage, or the most recent submission it's called. Women prisoners lose family access, submitted by Anonymous, 14th of July. Quote, our compassion as a society is affronted by this corrective services attempt to bring return business, said Brett Collins of Justice Action. Corrective Service decision to lessen family contact with women prisoners and children seeing their mothers is heartless mismanagement that will have disastrous effects on prisoners' rehabilitation. It is no wonder that the New South Wales Auditor General report from May 6th condemned Corrective Services policies which result in the highest recidivist levels, 45% in all Australia, said Kat Armstrong for Justice Action. At Emu Plains, women's prisons visits have been available for 7 hours on each day of weekends and holidays. The local Rotary Club organized a barbecue for the visiting families and children, and visitors came at times to soothe them during the days, often from long distances. So that's the feature story. There's lots of links and lots of
Emu Plains
related.
Where? Emu Plains, Australia?
That's Sydney Emu Plains.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Western Subs of Sydney.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I got that confused with the Coober Emu Plains where the Maralinga tests were.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
Yeah, come and visit your prisoners.
I felt like drawing the attention to that topic to read up on the story. That's only the sort of the basic feature front page story. There's links related stories and websites to contact. I think that's important. Anyway.
Who's going to deal with the consequences of that on the children of the prisoners? That's what I'd like to know. Yeah. Are social services prepared to or
police
or what may well already be the inadequate family support structures of the poor women in prison themselves, who are in jail whether or not they're in jail for something they did or deserve to be in there for. You don't punish their children for it. Yeah.
Well, we're about hitting 60 minutes.
I have heard that the most difficult thing to do is look through your father through the glass of Long Day Jail and try and talk to him on the phone.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're hitting 60 minutes, so shall we continue the program tonight? Go a bit longer? Yeah, okay. What's next up, then? I've done my recipe.
Seduna Bay. I saw a small CD video thing, which I'll give to you to put on the website, if you could.
Yeah, I will.
About some mining that's going ahead in this place called Seduna Bay. It's the Kolkotha Moola people.
Mm-hmm.
They're in South Australia. They own a lot of their land, the land that they live on and use, and actually still get medicines from and food and everything, and still are guardians of the pristine water in the rock holes around there in this very arid country. They're threatened by, and there's a lot of uranium mining companies all spreading themselves out through the country actually, but this is South Australia particularly. The national parks there aren't protected from mining interests. In fact, there's been legislation to make it easier for the mines to come in and lay claims. And this particular one is Yellowbinna National Park. There's another one. It starts with Y as well. But, I mean, I'll give you the website for this. It's Kolkotha Moola. kolkothamula.auspics.org. Have a look at that. It's really interesting. There, previously, the things that have stopped the mining there is the difficulty of getting water to these mines. Yeah, now, what they're going to do, this is way out in the Mallee Scrub. This is like the biggest area of Mallee Scrub intact left in the country. Yeah.
Can we explain what Mallee Scrub is?
Mallee Scrub is a small tree. It houses fowl.
Yeah, it lives. Mallee and Mulga Scrub usually lives off a lignotuber. Your soil's usually poor, well drained, but poor soils in a hot, sort of usually Mediterranean climates, like around Mildura, where you get wet winters and very hot, dry summers, and they rely on a lignotube of nitrogen fixation root systems. They sprout there, and they're a stunted version of a big,
this is the stunted Mallee Scrub. This is their Yeah. Well, you know, it supports life. It's
yeah.
supports life.
And that's that area is because of the mine.
What is happening at Ceduna Bay is that the water problems are being overcome these days by desalination plants all along the coast, which is going to disturb the soils around Ceduna Bay, which will then bring up sulfuric acid naturally. There's latent sulfuric acid in the soils there, and this is natural, but any disturbance of this is going to bring up the sulfuric acid
to sulfate soils,
okay, they're going to send pipelines straight through pristine country, not along the roads, straight through to the outback there where the Mallee is, and start there. Apparently they've found the world's largest zircon deposit there. The company are called Iluka Resources. Exactly. The company are called Iluka Resources. Every 6 months, the Kokopa Mula people invite people out to go and live in country with them and get taught, you know, what they know about the scrub.
Excellent.
It's worth a look at that website, and I'll give you the CD. There's a little movie presentation, very well done, shows you the facts.
Sounds fantastic, yeah.
Everyone can read up on their contacts and related topics.
Some of the most wisest water resource officers, too, are down in the Clarence Valley, where Tony and I both used to live for a long time, around Grafton, because...
I lived there, too, in that area.
On the lower Clarence, they've had a lot of bad experiences. I believe Mikolow Island was one, where they tried to farm cane on an island that was too low. It took off too much of the topsoil and exposed acid soils, and that remains a problem on the island to today. As well as those very widely derided plans, as Ian was mentioning before, to dam parts of the Clarence and then embroider and divert it west of the Great Dividing Range. Mm. One of the greatest pipe dreams. The experts are saying, you know, even if they were successful in getting this water over the range, it's gonna fall down into the water table and soak down into the ground within about 5 kilometres and make two-fifths of bugger all difference, except for maybe 3 kilometres up the Gwydir.
We need the Banglon from Macquarie Bank, and we need zirconium. It's vital to survive.
Hmm. Ask some of the people where they've had some of the worst experiences with unsustainable practices. They'll tell you a lot of these things are a pipe dream.
Not only will it disturb the Mallee scrub, it's going to really stuff up the fisheries and the oysters around the bays. They're still pretty much undeveloped, these bays, and they're just going to come in and go blop. And because they decide that the economic issues far outweigh the environmental issues.
Yep. Get Tipton to send a few people over there. I'm sure they'll be able to set them on the right track on a few basics anyway.
Yeah. Oh, well.
One of the big problem with this is the National Park assessments there, the zoning there. You know, it doesn't matter if you can fight until you drop to get a National Park zoned, because the mines can just come in and do what the hell they please. No one can stop them. Yeah. That's the constitutional challenge that we need.
That's what I was asking.
And this is why I was asking about the IR laws before, because they're through, but now we can contest them because of this thing,
It's all individual court cases, each one.
And more to the point, if Kim Beazley sticks to his guns, the people will have a chance to put this to the vote.
Yeah.
No. And so long as we have the...
Well, that's not going to work, brother, because you're not heard.
Yeah, that's right. We can't hear you from here, mate, but he's just saying they're not entrenched yet because we get the chance to put them to the vote, hopefully.
You need to speak in the mic, mate, otherwise it's useless. It's just
yes, we've got a man talking to us from down the corridor, but you probably can't hear it from there.
No.
Advice from the corner.
it's not there. No one can hear you there. You have to be near the mic. Anyway, if you want to join, please, welcome. Do I understand right that this... National Park, all these other things, we need to find a tool against mining as such, no? Which is not complying with best practices of environmental practices.
It just means facing a reality, you know. I mean, we can either go hell for leather and try and get as many resources out of the planet as possible and hope that technology, you know, overcomes the hurdle, or we can just say, well, stop. Let's stop now. Let's turn all our technology into recycling and getting us back on track. And work out at what rate can we achieve an equilibrium?
People like Malcolm Turnbull and the Macquarie Bank are not happy with that. They can't make profit with that.
They only live for, you know, only 20 more years maybe.
Yeah, no, for their kids too, they need to make profits on Halbrand screens where they can issue huge loans.
The kids have got good jobs, they've got plenty of money, they've got a future. Why should they worry?
Yes. We won't get to live long enough to use up all the landfill that we could create with the earth-moving equipment that it will take with the grandiose and pointless plan of carving a great hole out of the Great Dividing Range and diverting the Clarence River west into the interior.
Okay,
to have an effective countermeasure against that sort of rentalism, you know, you've got to put something in place which is more general, because there's always a wet dream of huge loans. Yeah, you can birth a scheme any nanosecond if you want to attract this sort of vandalism on nature in order to attract the bank loan, you know. And so mining itself needs to be scrutinized, in my view, you know, the practices of mining.
It's Australia, hidden from view, it's in the bush, no one sees it.
We've got to stop exporting. And which, you know, this is part of your wet dream thing. We get subsidized $9 billion a year for our coal exports. Mm. Now, they're pushing for more and more and more coal mines to push up that subsidy. They want to go through right through the Hunter, through the Caldera there. They want to go through Anvil Hill. If they get hold of Anvil Hill coal mine, if they end up putting that forward, that opens the gates. If we can't stop Anvil Hill coal mine from going ahead, then we can't stop unless we have great difficulty. Yeah. The rest of it. Yeah. That's why the IR law, like at this moment, is very important for us to face the mining issue. And this is worldwide. This is the Philippines, the gold mines there.
There's hardly anybody employed in mining compared with, say, media or with retail or finance advisor consultancies in the city. They're not sitting in the city. Those guys...
Awfully difficult to stop.
A handful of people, you know, they're not really relevant in this whole thing. I think it's the money thing. And how to regulate it, like make it ethical, you know.
That's why we mine in New Guinea, where no one can see what the tailings are doing.
Or here in Australia, for that matter, it's the same reason.
Mm.
Philippines, where they're up in the mountains and the tailings go straight down the rivers.
There's hardly any scrutiny in
this
country.
No one in the Philippines knows about these things.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, talking about wet dreams and, anyway, okay, and rivers.
But I'm not happy.
Yeah.
Pipe dreams, not wet dreams.
Yeah. Yeah, pipe dreams. Yeah,
drug inspired, not the result of out of control.
The only condolence I have is that I know that...
Ritalin inspired.
Okay, the Clarence scheme.
The only condolence I have in this whole thing is everybody's going to get damaged by radiation, even the rich.
Okay, apparently it's feasible and economical to divert the seaward flowing waters of the Upper Clarence, Namboida and McClay Rivers into the Murray-Darling Basin. It certainly needs a flush out to get rid of all that algae. The annual flow of water is comparable to that of the Snow Mountain scheme, apparently, and the catchment receives both the monsoon and winter rainfall flowing off the mountains in one of Australia's highest rainfall areas.
It's comparable to the Amazon, actually.
Is that right?
It is, yes. Apparently, if you took all the tributaries out of the Amazon, it still wouldn't pump as much water out in the ocean as the Clarence does on a typical day.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a big one. Economic? Why? Well, the Clarence scheme designs... Yep, the design by Professor Lance Endersby believes that surplus thermal energy from the Hunter and Latrobe Valley coal supplies and surplus weekend and night national grid energy could power and pump it by night and weekends uphill and then downhill via peak energy use periods. Economic? Oh boy, oh boy. Crop usage? Well, Professor Endersby also believes by doubling the use of water in the Murray-Darling Basin at a cost of $5 billion, this will provide for an increase in $20 billion worth of land use and agricultural profit. This involves a new diversion of weirs and pumping plants and irrigation systems to open vast tracts of land and irrigated agriculture. I personally would rather we planted trees and used sustainable native flora products that we can use the water already captured in the natural system, and this can avert salinity problems. Atriplex or saltbush used to fatten livestock if necessary, and acacia, native plums and condongs for us. Water volume use improvements in technology on one hand versus using and working with what is already there.
Okay.
Vertebra grass along the banks to keep them stable.
Right, guys, we've got a few minutes left for the show. Please come on if you have anything left to say.
I'll say goodbye with a small thing. I had a realist an opinionated, pragmatic gardening expert from, you know, from the Botanical Society over in England and has been trained up to the hilts. And he looked me straight in the eye and said to my question, yes, pedestrian cities will be a reality in the future. Mm. And 10 years ago, it was a schizophrenic fantasy of mine, you know.
So come along and have a look at our little pedestrian model here. I think we've got a very effective little town square where people seem to walk around and get around fine without the aid of vehicular transport.
We don't even have a tram.
And it would mean no schedules whatsoever.
Yeah. I sweat petrol when I run and walk. For my poor neighbours who need it. Anyway.
This is the last time I'll give this a plug, but if you're not at the Shannon already, you're listening to us. Shannon Hall gig right now, $8. All the bands and DJs are playing. It's to raise money for Tula with Alola in East Timor. It's happening right now, $8. Head over to the Shannon Hall. Have a good night.
Good night, guys.
Okay. Now,
see ya.
I've got to introduce Brian Hart from South Africa. Brian Hart working for St. Francis Hospice, which hosts, which looks after 500 kids roughly, or the number varies probably a little bit, who are suffering AIDS. Motor neuron disease, and they have no support. Most of those kids have no money to pay for their care. That's why Brian Howard made this series of reflections. You can get hard copies of them right in there. Check out the website. There will be an email and a website address of Brian Howard, which you can contact. I strongly recommend if you have any caring or charitable vein in your body. It would be worth having a contact and write to Brian what you think of his reflections. Today I present Brian with the Achilles heel.
Nice one, Brian.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I hope you can hear it. And catch you next week, all everyone.
See ya.
Cool.
Hi, this is Brian Howard from South Africa. Join me on NIM FM with Reflections. Achilles' heel. In the Greek mythology of the Iliad, Achilles was the bravest hero in the Trojan War. When he was born, his mother, Thetis, tried to make him immortal by dipping him in the river Styx. As she immersed him, she held him by one heel, but forgot to dip him in a second time so that the heel she held could be exposed to the water as well. As a result, the place where she held him remained untouched by the magic water of the river Styx, and that part of Achilles remained mortal or vulnerable. That's why today, any weak point is referred to as an Achilles heel. Now, we all have our Achilles heels. This probably explains why, when we take our marriage vows, the preacher or justice of the peace asks both parties whether they are prepared to love each other for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, for better or worse, and so on. These pledges are an acknowledgement that nobody is perfect. Our marriage declarations form part of a solemn oath to each other so that when the blindness of passion wears off, we'll remember our formal promises to accept our partner as he or she actually is and not as we imagined them to be during the heady days of infatuation leading to marriage. Personally, I think every married couple ought to receive a signed manifesto of their marriage vows to be framed and hung in a prominent place in the home for daily reference. Without such a constant reminder, sooner rather than later, we tend to notice and comment on our spouse's shortcomings, weaknesses, and irritating habits. Instead of complimenting each other on our mutual and individual strengths, we home in on our partner's Achilles heel. In Matthew 7, we are reminded, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way as you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." There's a popular psychological theory holding that if you want to reinforce someone's behavior, pay attention to it, reward it, notice it. Whether that behavior is good or not, the very fact that the person receives our attention, critical as it may be, will guarantee more of the same. From today on, how about making a concerted effort to ignore the imperfections we see in others, particularly the shortcomings of our loved ones? Instead, let's focus our attention on the good things that they do, the positive things they say, their accomplishments rather than their failures. Do the same thing for yourself. Leave your disappointments, your lost opportunities, and your incorrect decisions where they belong, behind you, in the past. Decide to face every new day with hope, anticipation, and the desire to be a little bit better than the person you were yesterday. You've heard it said that today is the first day of the rest of your life. I came across this wonderful comment that I'd like to share with you. Yesterday is a cancelled check. Tomorrow is a promissory note, an IOU. Today is ready cash. Use it wisely, for today is the most precious possession you have. Indeed it is.
Thank you for listening to Talk Tank. You can visit our website nimbinradiomedia.libsyn.com, Libsyn as in Liberated Syndicate, and check out other programs of Community Radio 2 NIM FM. Or you can write to us nimfm@nimfm.org, all small casing. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.